Good morning, fellow contenders. In all reality, we could say fellow fighters, couldn't we? We're in a war. We're in a life or death struggle. And each of us will come out on one side or the other. The captain of our salvation will be the winner, will triumph. And he has offered each of us all things that we need to join him in overcoming. Enjoyed our Sunday school discussion and our worship this morning. Last Sunday, I told the children that if I remember, we're going to find out what a word means that I read in my personal devotions. Jeremiah 4:22 says, "They are sottish children." Who looked up? Who can tell me what the word sottish means? Does anyone know? Maybe I am the only one that remembered. Any volunteers? What does sottish mean? Doran? Foolish. Very good. That's what I found too. They are foolish children. And last Sunday after the service, Brother Edwin came to me and he said, he asked me if I know what the Spanish Bible uses. And it uses a little different word that means a lot the same. And he said it uses the word ignorant. Ignorant. But look at the rest of this verse. I don't know if you're turned there, but the rest of this verse says, "For my people is foolish, they have not known me. They are sottish children, and they have none understanding." That sounds like they were very simple. Sounds like they didn't know anything. But the rest of the verse impresses me and challenges us, and we want to learn a lesson from this. "They are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge." We know that God makes people with different abilities. Some people learn very quickly. Some people work very hard to learn and to memorize and to understand things. And that's not what this verse is talking about at all. You notice the people here did not have a learning disability because they could sure enough learn the evil things. And they had done that. And God said they were wise when it comes to doing evil. They had filled their minds with all the wrong things. And children have a choice. We all choose what we're interested in and what we're going to learn about and what we're going to become interested in. Maybe you're interested in farming, or maybe you're interested in hundreds of different things. And that becomes, it explodes, that decision that you need to make, what you're going to be interested in, explodes as you become older and become teenagers. And in our world today, there are endless, foolish, ignorant, tons of garbage that we can choose to fill our minds and that make us people that become wise to do evil. They seem kind of innocent when we start filling our minds, but that's the end result. Things that are worthless, and they crowd out our understanding and our ability to understand the things that are good. And so that's my challenge to us. Let's, all of us, but especially young people, let's choose things that will not make us wise to do evil, but choose things that are good. Because it's important. The people Jeremiah was giving this message to were being warned of severe judgment, things that make me almost shudder to read in the book of Jeremiah. And that's the warnings they were being given. God told them they were going to be punished for these choices, and they were. I'd like to move into the sermon and just pick up right from there. because I'm reading through the book of Jeremiah, and there's a number of things that impress me in the book of Jeremiah, and a number of them are pointed out pretty clearly here in chapter 4. Look at verse 18. It tells us about the terrible condition of God's people. Thy way and thy doings have procured these things unto thee. This is thy wickedness, because it is bitter, because it reacheth into thine heart. From the inside out, these people were bitter and evil. And then God had told Jeremiah to tell the people of the judgments that were coming. And look at Jeremiah's, I don't know, would we call this anxiety? Look at verse 19. My bowels, I am pained at my very heart. My heart maketh a noise in me. What do you think it was doing? Do you think it was pounding in his chest that he could even hear it? And he almost couldn't handle it. I cannot hold my peace, because thou hast heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet and the alarm of war. God had told Jeremiah some terrible things that were happening, and it was just about to happen. And Jeremiah knew this, and he was in a panic almost, or maybe totally. And that impresses me about this weeping prophet. But look at verse 1. This is probably what impresses me most of all about Jeremiah's words. Even though these people were so far gone, we would say, so evil, God is saying, if you'll return, O Israel, return and put away your abominations. He was inviting them back. He was inviting them. But then if we turn over to Jeremiah chapter 12, God prophesies through Jeremiah what's going to happen. Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 15. And it shall come to pass, after that I have plucked them out. And that's what God did. He plucked them out of their homes, and many lost their lives, and they were taken and scattered. And God says, after I have plucked them out, I will return and have compassion on them, and will bring them home again, will bring them again, every man to his heritage and every man to his land. And it shall come to pass, if they will diligently learn the ways of my people to swear by my name, the Lord liveth, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then shall they be built in the midst of my people. But if they will not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation, saith the Lord. And we know the history of the Old Testament, of God's people, of Israel and Judah in the Old Testament, and how they rose and fell, and they chose sin, and God brought punishment, and then they turned to the Lord, and he'd bring them back home, and we shake our heads, and we say, could they never learn? And then we look at the New Testament era and the history of the church, and our heads stop wagging quite so much, and we start to look at ourselves, and we say, have we learned anything? Do we need to repeat these cycles, or don't we? What are we doing so we don't? And how about the Cornerstone congregation? And I'd like to just give us a brief refresher of some pretty recent history that directly involves this congregation. I'll try to do it briefly, but yet give enough details that some of us weren't here 11 years ago. And have come along through the history, through the time of this congregation. And I'll try to give enough details that you understand some of what has driven my burden this morning. It's my understanding that the first Sunday of July, 2012, so just a little over 11 years ago, was the first Sunday that those of you who used to worship in this building chose to worship separately from those that were still here. 11 years ago, I wasn't part of that group, but I heard and I remember clearly some of the concerns and the vision that drove that decision. And it wasn't easy. It was very difficult. And there were some dark days. There was a lot of uncertainty. What is the future? Can this happen? Can it work? Is it possible? And the meetings for prayer meeting and the traveling to Wellsboro for Sunday, and during those months, the strong pulling together was so necessary. And then fast forward just a little less than 2 years, and we're in 2014, and it's April. Somewhere I have record of the date, but it was sometime in April, I know. And there was a meeting, men's meeting, there in the lunchroom at the window shop. Brother Harry was there. And after a bit of discussion, there was a unanimous vote that it's time for this group to start its own school. Tremendous effort. So much to decide and to make happen in a little less than 5 months. But what a group effort and what a pulling together. And we had hours of hard work. And November that year then God called a minister from among us. And then a little less than 2 years later, in early 2016, I think it was in March, finally, through the working of protocols, but finally, this congregation was established officially. But in the meantime, we had clearly outgrown our accommodations. We were renting that building in Lodi, and there we were, often on a Sunday morning, 80 plus people, up to 100 people in that building, and there was parking for about 6 or 8 cars, half decent, and we parked all up and down the streets, and there was a single toilet in the whole building, and we said, something's got to change, and this is becoming unsuitable. And the building that we bought and worked so hard to get ready for that first term of school suddenly was busting at the seams, and we even used up the play area for a classroom, and it was just becoming impractical there. And I remember discussions and meetings, and we said, we've got to do something. And it looked pretty obvious that we needed to build a building to accommodate the group. But how and when and where, and most of all, how in the world were we going to pay for this? So expensive. Less than 2 years later, we're in January of 2018, and those of you who were part of Seneca and were meeting in this building had just gone through a very, very difficult year, 2017. And after some tough discussions and decisions, the decision was made that you would like to join us. And you had worked through that over a bit of time, and then when you sent that request, some of us remember very well having to work through and process that in our own minds and try to figure this out, and we had to mentally prepare because that kind of thing brings a lot of changes, and it was big changes, and we merged two congregations, and we changed where we meet, and we built a school building all in a year's time. And then just a little over a year after we moved into the school building, I almost said completed, but after we moved into the school building, we faced COVID and all of that and those challenges. And immediately after that, or during that and before that a little bit, and after that, over a period of a number of months, again, quite a few of you came to join us from Owasco and Waterloo, or Owasco Lake and Waterloo. And it's work, and there's challenges when you blend groups of people together. And each of those stages had its difficult parts. But I noticed one common thread through all that 11 years of history, and that was we recognized the human impossibility of what was ahead of us to make work. And we said, this is bigger than us. And I believe that drove us together, to work together, and to unite in common goal, and God works that way. And we could go all different ways with this. We could look at this and this history, the short history, and we could exalt God and the way he works and his faithfulness, and truly we owe him everything. We could look at our history and we could highlight the need of brotherhood and working together, and absolutely true. We could look at this and highlight the challenge, but the great need of having a functioning church and a school for our families, and that was a huge part of the inspiration that kept us going when it's tough. But the challenge to me this week, as I reflected, is the necessity of participation and engagement. And the Bible says that every member is needed. And that's what these challenging times brought out of this group. When it was a small group meeting for prayer meetings in 2012, there was no question. We were all needed there. Everybody needed to show up. And I remember the early days in Lodi Church, big building, small group. And you could almost tell on Sunday morning who wasn't there by whose voice you didn't hear singing. We were all needed, very needed. And it was obvious. And we had work days getting the school building ready, and we showed up, and it was a group effort, and everyone understood the urgency, and we pulled together. And I watched in amazement as we merged Cornerstone and Seneca, and we all knew that this was bigger than us. And we invited each other into our homes, and we put effort, and we were very intentional about making this work, and it did. And in 2020, the same thing. We invited you into our homes. We got to know you, not because it was an obligation, because we wanted to, and we knew that that's the way to make it work. We're going to have to become one, and it works. There was intentional engagement. People intentionally taking action. And here we are in 2023. You notice that this is almost longer than any of those time periods I mentioned. And here we are, full ministry team, a resident bishop. Our school has developed protocols, and we've been blessed tremendously by a committed group of teachers long term, and the stability that we gain from that. And the question that bothered me this week is, what is the impossible? What is the common goal today that's gonna engage us? Or have we maybe lost a little bit of it? Is it possible that we're settling back? Is that a thing of the past for this group? And I've heard some of us pining for the close connection and the involvement of the days gone by. And I think our memories are kind of selective sometimes, and we don't remember quite so accurately the extremely difficult parts of that as well, and the dark days. And I asked someone this week, what's the answer? Should we take this group and divide it into three small groups of about seven families or eight families? Would that be what it takes to keep fervor alive? Is size our enemy here? Is establishment our enemy? What will keep the history of this group right here, this congregation, from reading like the book of Jeremiah, where we're going to continue that rise and fall. As I was meditating on that yesterday, I something started tickling my memory from a while ago, and I went looking and I found it. It was in January of 2019. I preached a message here from, I forgot now which church in Revelation it was, the one that's called the Sleeping Church. We're going to look at that here in a couple weeks, those churches. But I read down over my notes from that message, and I'd like to repeat a paragraph that I had in my notes from that, from January of 2019. It is the natural tendency of humans and churches to forget, to let things slip, to become sleepy, to lose spiritual fervor and die. A church is only as alive and zealous as its individual members. And that's my burden in July of 2023 for the Cornerstone Congregation. And there's endless ways we could go with this to answer the question, what will it take to keep this group alive and engaged together and pulling together? And I've chosen to look at two aspects this morning in the negative of exactly what will kill this very thing that has brought us to this point. And Brother Delbert and Brother Ron could preach us each a message of what they comes to their mind, what burdens them and what it would take, and it would be entirely different. There's such a huge subject that there'd be lots of things left for you brothers in prayer meeting topics. And some of you have already not really mention it, but the things that you've chosen to challenge us with are exactly an answer to this question. What will it take? There's so many ingredients. I've given the sermon title four words. It's kind of wordy, but it captures, I believe, what I'd like to look at. Engagement and energy versus legalism and lethargy. There's some words in there we don't use every day, and there's some that we know very well what they mean. Engagement and energy versus legalism and lethargy. Like I said, we're going to spend most of our time, I believe, looking at the negative parts of this. What is legalism? Is it something that we should worry about? Is it something that could kill this brotherhood? Is it something that has sucked life out of this body already? So the dictionary says legalism is excessive adherence to law or formula. Strict, literal, or excessive conformity to the law. And for generations, Christians have grappled with and wrestled with the balance between personal relationship with God, personal convictions, being led of the Holy Spirit, versus group voice and church rules and brotherhood agreements. And this has been a swing in this way and that. And in our society, we're familiar, it was already mentioned in our Sunday school, we're familiar with a wide variety of churches, church types, church administrations, different sets of rules to follow. And when I said the word legalism, I guess there's a pretty good chance that a number of our minds went to a different group with a stricter adherence to a set of rules than what we feel we have here. And depends where I would bring up that subject, they would very quickly point to our church and say, right there, too many rules, legalism. Because we have a more detailed written agreement than a lot of audiences would. And we understand very well the danger of a very detailed written agreement, because the Bible says the letter of the law killeth. And we want the Spirit to make us alive. That's what we want. And so many, for generations already, many people have decided that the law is the problem. Get rid of the law. Throw it out. And that gives room for the Spirit. And over and over and over again, it's been proven that that approach does not produce long-term, consistent Christian living or spirituality, either one, not long-term. Other groups have noticed the lack of spiritual life in their group. It's evidenced by actions and things they see, and so they make a rule. We're going to get rid of the problem. We're going to get rid of the problem and write rules and write rules. And it doesn't produce spirituality. But there's another side, another perspective that I'd like to look at in relation to legalism that I haven't considered very often. And I suggest it may be the answer to the dilemma that Christians have struggled with for a long time. Let's think about United States of America. We live in a very legalistic society. Our country has more laws and more ordinances and more bylaws and regulations than anybody knows. It's impossible for anyone to have to even grasp half of them. And so the way we relate to this is we comply with the ones that we know about, and we try not to know too many, and we kind of watch which ones are enforced, and we kind of find a minimum of where we can stay out of trouble. That's how the United States lives. That's how people live. And we have varying comfort levels of where that could be. Because I don't know of anyone that's sitting somewhere poring over law books trying to figure out how they could comply more perfectly with the laws of the USA. No, it's a wasted effort. I think of one building contractor we did business with years ago that got pretty close. That fellow knew about more laws and had more things in place than anybody else I knew, and I shook my head. I don't know how he stayed in business. He overregulated himself, like, in my opinion. But that's the climate we live in. And I suggest that the part of legalism that is most dangerous to our group today is to relate to our Christian life just like we relate to the overregulation of civil government. And we just bump along trying to find the balance of how to become engaged and involved as little as possible and to follow as little of the letter of the law as we can and stay out of trouble. We try to find the bare minimum of where we can come this far, and our conscience is pretty well at rest, and nobody's given us any problem, and so we just kind of bump along. That's how we live in the civil climate of our day. How much of the law must I comply with, and how much can I still please myself? That's legalism. And either aspect of legalism is fatal to vibrant brotherhood. Both are carnal, whether it's the strict following, check all the boxes, watch very carefully, get all everything just right, and nothing changes in the heart. It kills brotherhood. Just as much, the constant juggling of the minimum, comparing myself with my brother, trying to stay just inside the line, is carnal. That's what it is. It's living for the flesh. It's evidence of the letter having killed. And it's an awful drain on the brotherhood. I had a conversation recently with a brother who felt that our conference is plagued with this curse. Way too much of, well, tell me what the rule is so I can come right up to it and not go any further. And I hope he's wrong. And I trust that's not our condition here, because if it is, vibrant Christian church life as we've known it is on the way out. It doesn't work. And I've experienced better here. And as a group, we have plugged in and we've become involved, not just to meet a minimum, but collectively, we have a good report of engaging. And I like to think about the positive side of this. Legalism is the negative. And engaging is the opposite. It's like two gears. When two gears mesh together, they are engaged, they lock into each other, they spin the same speed, they turn in unison, and they accomplish impossible things of one by itself. That's how I know you. That's the vision I have for us to continue, and I'd like to challenge us in that. To not be slothful in business, but fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. And the word fervent there, Strong says, gives a picture of a boiling liquid or a glowing solid, something that is hot. The exact opposite of the lukewarmness that Jesus finds so repulsive. Turn to John chapter 8. Let's look at Jesus' example in this engagement. Being engaged, being locked in, being bought in, being pulling together, engaged. John chapter 8, verse 29. He's talking about, in verse 28, about the time when he'll be lifted up, he'll be crucified. Verse 29, and he that sent me is with me, the Father hath not left me alone. For I do always those things that please him. You see, the complete engagement of Jesus, like those two gears locked in. I do everything that pleases my Father. That's the purpose of my life. Jesus wasn't just bumping along in life, kind of popping in and out of gear, just whatever it took to stay ahead of the trouble, that the consequences that he was afraid of. Absolutely not. Jesus was in the synagogue. He was working. He was serving. And all of that giving and giving and giving, to the point that it tells us that they hardly had time to eat or sleep. And all of that, and he knew full well it was leading up to the ultimate sacrifice. But he was engaged, and he was giving it his all. And he does all things. I do always those things that please him. What a wonderful example. Cheerful obedience to his Father. It says he was obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And in that same chapter, we recognize those words from Philippians 2. And Paul told the Philippians, he said, wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. And I challenge us personally and collectively to be engaged to that level, to where Paul would write to us, your obedience is the same whether I'm there or not. And it's God working in you, and you're engaged, and the gears are locked together, and you're able to accomplish great things, both to will and do of his good pleasure. I'd like to look at the second one, the second brotherhood killer, the second church destroyer, and that's lethargy. The only time I remember ever hearing that word used is lethargic. Lethargy is often in relation to someone who's very sick. And they have so little energy left, it's hardly even worth it to them to open their eyes. And if they do, it's not even worth their eyes following you in the room. Often maybe a little child with a high fever, and they become lethargic, and they're just so wore out, it's not worth much effort. They don't have much energy to put into it. And I like to think about that a bit, energy versus lethargy. And the challenge for us is to not become weary and to lose our alertness. There's a real sense that we are experiencing today what looked like an impossibility in 2012, 2013, some of those early years. But the Lord has worked miracle after miracle and established a church and school here and a brotherhood. But we are humans. And when humans are part of a system that is fully set up and operational and the wheels are turning, we tend to lose focus. We tend to sit back and become lethargic. Many a business has failed because the rigors of startup are past, and then they've kind of not produced a plan to move them forward. Many an organization has had itself lulled to sleep by the wheels and the hum of the wheels of regularity and things just going on. And people lose their focus. It's a very common human problem. But before a business fails, before a business loses its vision, before it loses its energy, there are individuals, the individuals who show up for work every day have personally lost it, before it becomes obvious in a collective way. And before a church, before a congregation of believers loses its vision and energy, the individual members forget. The individual members cool in their calling of and their purpose in the Church of Jesus Christ. Jesus warned us numerous times not to become sleepy, not to become sidetracked by the cares of this world, not to become distracted because he and disoriented because he delays his coming. And he's told us numerous parables, enough that it should have our attention. And we should be well aware of not only the potential, but the propensity, the likelihood of myself as a human having that problem. Why did Jesus wasn't wasting words? He didn't repeat it several times because it might happen, but a small chance. I think we're all human enough to understand that. And I'd like to just look in closing at what he told us in Matthew 24. He was telling of the coming of the Son of Man. He said these verses that we're familiar with. He said, one shall be taken and one shall be left. And he talks of that time and importance of being ready. And let's read Matthew chapter 24, starting at verse 42. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched, and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant, whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I'm impressed that Jesus says not only watch, but do you notice that this servant shall be so doing? There's doing to be done. And he picks up on that in chapter 25, and we're not going to read this, but the next two parables he says, the first one is of the virgins, and those 10, 5 wise and 5 foolish. And he highlights the responsibility of having the provisions and watching and being ready. But then the next parable he tells about a lord who goes away and leaves his servants with some talents. Not only were they supposed to take the talent and keep it safe and sit on it, but they were to be working and they were to be busy and were to be bringing increase for the Lord so that when he comes back, they're profitable to him. You notice the importance of watching while we're busy. That's what the Lord left us to do. And let's not be distracted and disoriented by the Lord delaying his coming. That's what happened here. These evil servants, they began to smite each other and to get carried away with drunkenness. And it's in each of us that potential as we wait. And if we're going to be of those wise servants, we'll need to be busy, and we'll need to identify causes that are worth pulling together for, or we'll fall apart. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. When Paul was writing the first book of Corinthians, the first letter to the Corinthians, he gave them a lot of harsh things there. But then he got to the last chapter, and it's very interesting to me to notice some of the challenges and the endearing things that the apostles wrote in the last chapters of their letters. And we have this verse in 1 Corinthians 16:13. Watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, be strong. And that's my challenge to each of us personally, but also collectively. Let's watch and be strong, and let's be engaged with energy. Let's kneel to pray.